He was known as Davy the Punk. The son of immigrants, he grew up in a tenement in a Jewish ghetto known as The Ward, one of Toronto's most impoverished neighborhoods at the turn of the century. But to Bob Bossin, Davy the Punk was dad. As a boy, the renowned Canadian folk singer and founder of String Band knew nothing about his father's nickname and little about his past in the gambling underworld of the 1930s and 1940s. One summer day in the 1970s, Bossin had lunch at United Bakers Dairy Restaurant, which was a fixture of the Jewish community in Toronto. It had opened in 1912. Anyway, there was a chance conversation which revealed that Davy was said to be a gangster. More than 40 years later, after digging into the nooks and crannies of Davy's life, Bob Bossin has written about his father and a Toronto that was rife with gambling, anti-Semitism, and a host of colorful characters. Now, being a folk singer, of course, he has put some of the stories to music, which he has performed in many parts of the country. And he's written a book that is just out. It is called Davy the Punk, A Story of Bookies, Toronto the Good, The Mob, and My Dad. And Bob Bossin joins me this morning in our studio in Toronto. Good morning.
Hi.
So you go into the restaurant and you order a bagel and a schmear or something.
Yes.
And how did, tell me what happened, the conversation.
The counterman, who I think was one of the owners, was ancient or looked ancient to me at the time. He's probably younger than I am now. And I was just kibitzing with him at the counter. And I said, how long have you been in Toronto? And in fact, he said, länger wie meine Zähne, longer than my teeth. So I asked if he knew my family, and he started to reel off the names. Yeah, I knew the Bossins. I knew Becky, Bessie, Hi, R, Davy. And I said, well, Davy, my father had died when I was young. I said, Davy was my dad. And he said, sure, I knew Davy. We used to call him Davy the Punk. And
He called him a Farbrecher.
Yes,
In Yiddish, which means?
Well, it depends. A gangster is how I translate it, or outlaw, or lawbreaker. A lawbreaker.
Did it set you back a bit?
A little bit. I mean, my father was a very interesting, very interesting man, very interesting past, but he was an odd man in that in some contexts, he was virtually silent. I mean, people who knew him but not really well thought he was mute. I mean, he simply did not speak. Some people said they thought he was shy. Some people said they thought he liked horses better than people. I think he simply lived outside the law, and he knew that what you don't say can't be used against you. In fact, I remember him saying to me, Bobby, a fish don't get caught if he keeps his mouth shut. But around his close friends and family, he was very articulate, a terrific storyteller.
He didn't tell jokes, he told stories.
That's right. That's a real distinction for him.
Yeah.
But I think that was something of that culture, of that Jewish immigrant culture, because I've read accounts of some of the top gangster names, and they were the same. They liked to sit around and over a corned beef sandwich and tell stories. So I knew something. I knew he'd been involved in the gambling business. I didn't know a lot about it. And, in a way, I think that was more that I was a kid and a teenager, and I didn't ask.
Now, his career, however you define it or characterize it, was in the 30s, 40s in Toronto?
It was probably starting even earlier.
All right.
He grew up in the slum in the ward.
Tell me about that Toronto. What was it like then? It was called Toronto the Good or Little Belfast at one point, but it wasn't Toronto the Good for your dad.
No.
Jews.
Well, the ward was really was a terrible slum. And in fact, there was a report in 1912 about it that really lays it out that I think Mackenzie King had something to do with as a young man. I think he was one of the researchers on it. But it was smelled foul. I mean, it was really a terrible place.
It was right downtown.
Yeah, yeah. It ran between College and Queen and Young and University was
essentially where the new city hall is.
Yeah, and the hospitals, all that was built up over what used to be the slum. And, it was pretty rough. I mean, I think Davy quit school and went out to peddle papers when he was, as soon as he was old enough to protect the money he made from the bigger kids and bring home money to the family. But it was interesting, as I talked to different members of the family and different people, I think for Davy and certainly for some of his brothers, they loved it. Almost everybody they knew was Jewish. So, you know, they didn't experience, in the broader sense, they experienced the anti-Semitism, which was absolutely rife in those years. But in many ways, it had a freedom that their parents never had in the shtetls and in the Pale in Europe.
Did he have ambitions to be a doctor or a lawyer or something? Did he want to get the ghetto behind him and move into more established Toronto?
I think
Toronto?
They all did. And in fact, the United Bakers Dairy started in the ward in the shadow of the Teton clothing factory. Eaton's wouldn't hire Jews for their department stores, but the clothing factory was 80% Jewish. So it started there. But then as soon as people made, you know, established themselves just enough, they moved over to Kensington and Spadina, which is, and the United Bakers Dairy moved with them. So I'm sure he had that kind of ambition. But as I recall him, he died when I was 17. He loved the street and he loved the Luftmenschen, the people who, you know, got by the skin of their
The rounders.
Yeah, the rounders. I think he was very comfortable in that world. Now, his father, one of his sisters told me, wanted Davy to be a lawyer. The old man didn't.
This was Zussman.
Zussman. The old man didn't believe in education except for Davy. I mean, he recognized that Davy was a really smart guy, but he might have been. I mean, a few people made it through, but there were an awful lot of barriers to Jews and the professions, and I think he wound up in the gambling business because it was a white-collar business where you could be creative and all those things, and there was no bar on the door to it.
Tell me about the gambling business in those days. Now, in the U.S., Prohibition was in effect, which created organized crime, I guess, in a way. What was the situation in Toronto for gamblers? Was it all horse races, or was it card games?
Well, sure. There were a lot of different forms. It's hard to see now, but horse racing through much of the 20th century, really up till about 1970, was bigger than football is now and baseball, which was popular then too. And because, in part, it was the cheapest form of entertainment. You know, for a 25-cent bet on a horse, you could be excited, you could hang out with the guys, you could follow the ponies. It was very, very popular, and it was legal to bet at the track where the rich could go in the afternoon,
right,
and it was illegal for everybody else.
Let's get into some of the technicalities of this. The people who bet off track, that is, they didn't go to the racetrack, watch the race, and lay down a $2 bet or whatever, used bookmakers or bookies. What was the bookie?
The bookie would take bets with a 10% vigorish, it's called, so that he paid out 10% less than he took in, and that's essentially where he made his
profit.
Money. But what two things really brought in the gambling business as a major industry, and it was a major industry. One was that as the telegraph really became widespread. I mean, it started in the 1860s, but by the turn of the century, the telegraph allowed for the results of a horse race to be spread immediately after the race. So prior to the telegraph, there wasn't an industry. People could bet locally, but it would take 3 days to find out who won at Hialeah or what have you. But when the telegraph came in, I think the fifth biggest user of the telegraph in the early years was what they called the race wire, was this getting racing results out. Well, once you could get those results, people could know how they did on the first race, and bookmakers who had to handle the money, even more importantly, they could know how they did.
How would I find a bookmaker in those days? Would I go to a certain place and knock on a door and say that Joe sent me, or would I?
Well, or you go up to a newsie on the street, and I mean, a lot of them were front ends for bookmakers, and I mean, it was pretty widely known. In fact, somebody said there was a time that along Queen Street in Toronto on a summer day when the race results were being called over the telephone and a loudspeaker that you could walk down the street and not miss a furlong of the race hearing the results coming out onto the sidewalk.
Now, you are sitting there with a guitar in your hand, and you're telling some of these stories in music, which, of course, you've been doing all your life, really, right, as a folk singer.
Yeah, it was a pretty natural... Well, I really wanted to write the book.
Right.
In fact, when I turned 60, I had this little epiphany, which was, if there's something you've always wanted to do and you haven't done it yet, when do you think you're going to do it? And so I basically went off the road and wrote the book.
So did you take episodes in Davy's life or particular subjects like horse racing and gambling and write songs about it?
It's a shorter version of his story, and it's different writing for the stage than writing for the reader. Uh-huh. And so they're two somewhat different skills.
Have you got something you can play for
us?
Yeah.
All right, this is the opening of Act Two.
This is Bob Boston.
Camp Town racetrack 5 miles long, all the doodah day, gwanna run all night, gwanna run all day, bet my money on the bobtail nag, somebody bet on the bay, somebody bet on the bay. All horse players die broke, it's a sure thing, it's all she wrote. It's a long walk home from an empty park. The big win and the fresh start, or a torn ticket and a broken heart. As Socrates once spoke, all horse players die broke. Zack Snyderman made his peace with the ponies long ago. All my life, he'd say, I heard about guys who got rich playing the horses. But the funny thing is, I never met any of them. But Zack loved the races. So when he retired, he used to go out to the track every day there was a meeting. Now, he had a system. He'd put $2 in his pocket, take a racing form, and head to the track. And he'd bet the $2 on the first horse he liked. And if he lost, well, it was a cheap day in heaven. But if he won, he'd take his winnings and he'd put them on the next horse he liked. And if he won again, he'd do it again. Zack was a disciplined and a patient man. Well, one day, he went out to Long Branch, one of the tracks just outside of Toronto, had his $2, looked at the racing card, and he saw in the first race a filly that he'd been keeping his eye on running at a very good price, so he bet the $2. Horse came in, paid $28. Now he had $28, he looked at the card again, saw another horse that he liked and respected in the second race, bet the $28. That horse won, paid $5. He had $70. Well, he didn't like anybody in the third race or the fourth race, but in the fifth race there was a colt, a one-year-old running that he knew and liked, and so he followed his system, bet the $70. Horse came in, paid $18. He now had $630. Bet the whole thing on the sixth race. He won again on the seventh, and he won again, and by then, Zack had over $16,000. Now, I mean, I, or perhaps you, would have quit while we were ahead or put the lion's share aside, but Zack was a disciplined man with a system. He looked at the card, and in the eighth race, there was a horse by the name of Dark Chocolate, quite a good winning horse. So he took his entire stake and he bet it on dark chocolate. Well, dark chocolate ran up the alley, as they say. She lost. So when Sack got home, his wife Sadie said to him, "How did you do?" He said, "Same as always, I lost $2. All horse players die broke. It's win on the filly, lose on the colt. It's a pawn ticket and a pocket full of tin. The smell of the turf when the day begins. And every two-year-old could win. Horse players live in hope, but all horse players die broke. Hey, buddy, you got a spare smoke?"
That is Mr. Bob Boston, a great folk singer, of course, and author now of Davy the Punk, the story of his father. There are so many characters in this book because there were so many characters in the profession, right? And your dad knew them. Tell me about Abe Orpin. Who was he?
Oh, Abe Orpin's a wonderful character from back in Toronto history, and maybe with luck people will send in some other stories about him. I could not find a living relative to talk to, although there must be some. Abe Orpin was, he was Irish, Protestant, and he was born in Canada in the mid-1800s, I think. No, earlier, even earlier than that. And he grew up here, and he was a laborer and did various things. But fairly early on, he wound up as a publican, and he decided he would have some fun and make some money by betting the price of a beer against his customers. And it would amount to the same thing. It was a 50-50 proposition. They'd flip a coin, I think, is how he did it. Anyway, the bookies and the gambling people hung out, and he appreciated them as customers and really learned his stuff. And he was a major, major figure in gambling starting at the turn of the century. First, he had a gambling club down on King Street, and then eventually the Brown Derby out on the Brown Derby was Manny Feeders. The National Sporting Club out at the mouth of the Humber River. That was later. And he started building racetracks. And he was an incredibly loved citizen. He did all sorts of good works and helped people out. He used to, every Friday, he would be in his office and through the Depression, and people could just come and give him a story. And he had a cash box on his table, and he would dole out some money. In fact, Sammy Lufspring,
the Jewish Canadian middleweight champion,
went to Abe Orpin because he wanted to go to the championships. We're in Edmonton, and he couldn't afford it. And Orpin said, "Do you think you'll win?" And Sammy said, "I've won 70 fights." And Orpin said, "Okay," and gave him $100. And In his biography, Lufspring said he'd never seen that kind of money in his life. He practically had the ink squeezed out of the bills by the time he got back to Kensington. Anyway, he was a great character and ran gambling, and everybody knew it. And they said that you didn't get to be on the police force unless he approved you.
Well, that, you raise an interesting point there. Now, where were the cops in all of this? Were they Were they friendly to the gamblers? Were they perhaps employed by some of them, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Although Toronto was not an open town in the way Montreal was or Vancouver was or Halifax
or
was.
Or Buffalo.
In the States, many places.
Yeah.
But there certainly were people on the path. There certainly were people looking the other way. Now, I've forgotten the year. I think it was in the 20s. Dennis Draper was brought in to clean up the police force. And Draper, for his many shortcomings, which include fierce anti-communism, fierce anti-Semitism, he equated Jews and communists.
And anti-union, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Draper's dragoons
exactly.
Were the cops.
He ran a tight ship. And so the corruption was not the widespread kind of thing it was in Montreal. But at the same time, people would tell stories to me as I was collecting them about people on the take. Toronto was somewhere in between, I think, in that regard. Although there's a nice story about Orpin. Orpin was called in, was subpoenaed to testify at an inquiry into police corruption. And he was asked if he was ever warned in advance of a raid. And he said, oh, yes, I always know when the police are coming. Well, this caused a great stir. And he was asked how he knew. And he said, well, the police ring the doorbell. No one else does.
When you were doing the research and talking to all the people who knew your father, was that the question that was foremost in your mind? Was he a gangster?
No. He was a very moral and upright guy in his own way. His own morality, which didn't see anything wrong with people, with poor people betting on horses as well as rich people. But no, he didn't drink. He smoked cigars a bit, but he didn't really smoke. He was quite an upright character in his own odd way. There were no guns around the house, and really that Jewish gambling business was a pretty civilized one. In fact, I talked to a bookie I talked to who's now deceased. I was talking to him. I said, well, you know, what do you do when somebody doesn't pay up? And he said, what do? I don't take his bets anymore. And I tell the other guys, that's all. He says, the Italian guys, they get their ego all caught up in it. But he says, I don't. And so I knew him. It wouldn't make any sense for him to be a gangster in the sense of a violent man. This was an illegal industry, but I don't think he was a gangster.
Why did he decide to get out of the business and go straight in the 1930s? He opened a talent agency.
Yeah, talent agency, theatrical attractions. Yeah. And there's different stories about it. My mom said he got out in part because I was, you know, getting to be 4 or 5 years old and they didn't want me to grow up in that world.
Uh-huh.
And so he got into show business. Look what happened. He was a pretty smart guy, I guess, in that way. I asked him, it's one of the few questions I really remember asking him. Actually, I remember asking him if he knew Al Capone, and he said he didn't. I was very disappointed at the time. But I asked him why I got out, and I remember he said the business was getting mean. And in fact, that was very prescient. It really did turn ugly as Genovese took over from Costello. The Hamilton mob moved into Toronto. Toronto was not a mafia town in the 30s and 40s, and there were reasons for that. Buffalo was, Hamilton was. And in fact, there's a story somebody told me about my dad that must have been from that period, probably in the late 40s, beginning of the 50s, that a couple of goons from the big mafia family in Buffalo.
The Magadino family.
The Magadino family came up and went into my dad's office and said, Mr. Magadino wants to be your new partner. And apparently my dad, who everybody said had nerves of steel, picked up the phone, dialed, got the Toronto police, asked for the morality squad, and said, there's a couple of guys here putting the muscle on me, and then handed them the phone. And whoever was at the other end said, you guys, there's a train leaving for Buffalo in an hour. Either be on it or stay here for the next 10 years. So I guess it was a combination of reasons.
All of this research, all of the writing, and all of the interviewing you did, did it bring you closer to your father, you think, in any way?
I think the answer to that is yes. I mean, it's so complex, you know, in that our relations with our fathers, it's like breathing air. You know, it's everything good that happened. It's everything bad. And I have trouble making distinctions among all those things. But he died when I was 17. And, you know, when you're a teenager, I was trying to get more freedom. And I think he knew, I think he was quite wise in this, that I never had the street smarts he had. So he worried about me. And I had no worries. I grew up protected. And so we were having some battles in the last year of his life as I would miss my curfew and be out a little too late. In fact, I'll tell you another quick story. I loved Shelley Berman as a kid, one of
Wonderful.
My idols. And one day I was out with my pals and I was supposed to be home at 11 or whenever it was. And that was a little late, and I finally got in, and my mom said, "Oh, I'm so sorry you weren't here before, because my dad, because Davies was going down to the Club Indigo with Shelley Berman, and he really wanted you to go, but they had to leave." Oh, no!
Do you think, let me ask you finally, do you think you know more about yourself through knowing more about your father?
Yeah, in some ways, and about my grandfather, too, which was also part of this research. And that was something I did periodically. See, the biggest question for me in how to write the book was what's the voice? What kind of book is this? It was the moment that I thought, this is storytelling. I'm going to tell stories just the way my dad did and his pals did as they were sitting around the Sea High or sitting in the bleachers at Maple Leaf Stadium. I don't have to be a historian. I don't have to be a biographer. I can tell the stories. Initially, I mean, I looked at both these guys, at my grandfather and at my father, and I can't put myself in that situation, growing up in that slum in the ward, or the grandfather leaving the old country when he was 40 and coming to this new world. But in their attitudes, I mean, I realized they've been passed down, and I suddenly could picture my grandfather, who died before I was born. I could picture the twinkle in his eye, even though he was a religious Jew and he'd left the old country and all of these things. And I think there's a lot of attitudes that were passed down, or ways of looking, ways of doing things, not the things we did because they're all different, but the way we did them. I suspect it's a pretty straight line.
Well, the stories you tell and the stories he told are fascinating. I'm glad you did them. I'm glad you're telling us.
Yeah, I'm very proud of the work. It took me 10 years.
Wow.
And not counting all the time before that I wanted to do it, but truly is a labor of love.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for coming in. Before you leave, can you give us another song about your dad?
All right. When my dad died, I remember I asked my mother if he'd left us, you know, any instructions, and she didn't say anything, and she got a funny expression, and then she finally sort of smiled and said, "He said to scatter his ashes on the racetrack." We didn't do it, but I kind of think with the show and all that, I'm doing it now, so that's where this song came from. Scatter my ashes on the racetrack. There's no ground so sacred or pleasant. The very best thing is when your horse comes in. The next best thing is when it doesn't. Dust on the wind, sun on the silk, nose on the wire. The punters all kicking themselves. The worst day at the races, I wouldn't trade places for the worst day anywhere else. Worst day any place else. Scatter my ashes on the back stretch. It is my bequest and donation for the study of horses and the study of man. There's no finer field of education. A steady hand, a watchful eye, a patient heart, for the lessons a boy must accrue. There's Harvard and Stanford, but I'll take my chances at good old Woodbine U, dear old Woodbine U.
Bob Boston is the author of Davy the Punk, a story of bookies, Toronto the Good, the Mob, and my dad. It's published by the Porcupine's Quill Press. This morning he was with me in our studio in Toronto. You're listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1, and across North America on Sirius XM. My name is Michael Enright.